Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Spiritual Hollywood Hour. I am Kate Romero, your host of Spiritual Hollywood, and I would like to say thank you to BBS Radio, Don Newsom, Doug Newsom, and Seth Hendrick over there for just doing miraculous things with BBS Radio, and I'm very excited about the things to come. And I really appreciate having a platform to raise consciousness by using Hollywood and do my little part to make a difference any way that I can. I have, speaking of making a difference, as my guest this evening, Mike Robbins and Suzanne Grotz, who works with Marcy Shymoff, just raved about this man, and I said, send him on over. I want to see what he's all about. And he wrote a delightful book called Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken, Transform Your Life with the Power of Authenticity. And Mike Robbins' website is, if you want to go check that book out, it's www.beyourselfbook.com. BEYOURSELFBOOK.com. And for anyone who would like to call in, I just want to give you those numbers at the top of the show. So you can do that anytime you feel inspired. It's toll-free in the U.S., 877-876-5227. Toll-free in Canada is, okay, I don't need glasses. I think it says 888-815-9756. How embarrassing. But I'm being authentic. And the direct line is 530-876-3222. And I'm going to let you know a little bit about Mike Robbins' background just before I bring him on, and then he can tell you the rest. He's an author of the new book, as I said, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken, Transform Your Life with the Power of Authenticity, and also another best-selling book called Focus on the Good Stuff, The Power of Appreciation. Wow, that's an awesome topic, too. As well-known keynote speaker and personal development expert, Mike has inspired tens of thousands through his speaking, workshops, coaching, and writing. He empowers people to be grateful, passionate, and authentic in their work, relationships, and their lives. Prior to becoming an author, speaker, and coach, Mike was drafted by the New York Yankees out of high school, but chose instead to play baseball at Stanford University, where he pitched in the College World Series. Mike was drafted by the Kansas City Royals out of Stanford and played three seasons of professional baseball in the Royals organization before arm injuries ended his playing career while he was still in the minor leagues. After his authentic athletic career was cut short, Mike worked in sales and business development for two internet startup companies, and he has extensively studied many disciplines of both personal and professional development and received training from the nationally acclaimed Coaches Training Institute. Mike uses this background, knowledge, and experience to impact the individuals and groups with whom he works. Again, that website is www.beyourselfbook.com. Without further ado, I'd love to bring on Mike Robbins for you. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Kate. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm good. And you know, that word authenticity just keeps falling out of my mouth ever since I picked up your book.
It's a good word, isn't it?
Yeah, so you're an authentic athlete, apparently.
Well, I tried to be the best I could when I was playing. I don't know that I was always authentic on the field. You know, it's a little tough sometimes.
Well, you know, life is the process that teaches us authenticity.
Absolutely.
Or you know, we go the opposite direction, which is, you know, both of them are equally as detectable.
Yes.
And it looks like you chose authenticity absolutely in Technicolor.
Well, you know, I appreciate you saying that. And one of the things I talk a lot about, both in my book and as I'm speaking about it quite a bit these days, is that, first of all, I believe in the theory that we teach best what we most need to learn. As I was joking with a friend of mine the other day, I said, hey, if you want to get in touch with how full of it you are, just write a book on authenticity. you'll find out in a hurry, you know. And I think it's important, though, because the whole first third of my book, and whenever I'm speaking about this or doing workshops, I spend a good amount of time talking about why I think it's difficult for me personally, for a lot of people that I know and have worked with over the years, and for most people I meet, to really be real and be authentic. And that's actually, in my opinion, good news, because if we can start getting in touch in a compassionate and honest and empathetic way with ourselves and others in terms of why it can be difficult to be real, really speak our truth, live our truth in life, that's how we can start to access a deeper place of authenticity within us.
I agree with you completely. And I had an insight about an hour ago that just bonked me in the head.
Yep.
And here's the insight. You tell me what you think about this.
Okay.
I had an insight that authenticity is the direct antithesis to status quo.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that rang my truth meter like crazy, and
yeah.
I was like, oh, my gosh.
Well, and the thing about that I would say is absolutely, and the caveat, even though it's kind of a funny word to use always, with anything related to authenticity is that it's got to be real. So, you know, when we start to define it, you know, here's the trouble. People ask me all the time, you know, I just wrote a whole book on authenticity. They say, well, what does it mean to be authentic? And, you know, my answer is always, I don't know. Because I really don't. I can't say what that is for you.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say what that is for. I can hardly say what it is for me half the time.
Yeah.
And it changes in a moment by moment way. So the thing is, the only thing we can know is right now what's true and real.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, in most moments in our lives, now there are moments we're aware of the fact that we're not being honest or we're withholding something. But for the most part, we're walking around in life being as authentic as we know how to be in each interaction and moment of life. And it's often not until after we go, oh boy, just being kind of phony there. Or sometimes, you know, it's later in life, you look back and go, geez, remember how I used to be when I was in my 20s or whatever, you know, whatever
right.
point it was, or my 30s or my 40s. I mean, you know, we always have that perspective. So the antithesis of status quo, absolutely. And if it starts to become a shtick, if you will, like some people's version of authenticity is being provocative and being argumentative and in everyone's face. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I had a woman in a workshop the other day who's in her 50s who told me that her mother used to dress her in blue when she was a child and people thought she was a boy and it really upset her. So she decided that she hated blue and she never wore it. And she said, at some point in my early 50s, I stopped and went, wait a minute, do I actually like blue or not? And it was like this simple thing, but she realized, I do. I've been living my whole life mad at my mother about lots of things, but particularly this thing about blue, and I never wore it, never had anything blue. And I realized that was actually inauthentic because I was just reacting to this thing that happened to me when I was a kid.
Yeah, and speaking of kids, I'd like to just ask you how you feel about this.
Mm.
Now, I know that you have a wonderful wife named Michelle, and
yes.
you have two beautiful daughters named Samantha and Anna Rose, and
I
you
do.
Have two adorable cats named Gouda and Emma.
Yes, well, you know all kinds of stuff about my family. I love that.
Yes, and family's so important. And,
yeah.
and I'm about to make a really great point, I think.
Okay.
And if I comb my hair right, no one will see it. So what I want to bring up is that children and animals cannot help but be authentic.
Yeah.
They There's... know no other thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, sadly, you're absolutely right. And I think what I see, and then my daughters are such great teachers. You know, Samantha is just over 3,
mm-hmm.
very, very passionate, and Anna Rose is just about to turn 9 months. So we're still in the early stages of parenting. The, you know, the boot camp version of it is what a lot of people tell me. You know, not a lot of sleep at our house and all that. But great example, both of authenticity of children, but also how it starts to get trained out of them. Just last week, Samantha had a friend over, sweet little girl, who brought a gift for her. And I was in the other room, and I heard Michelle, my wife, with the two girls in the other room, and, you know, Samantha's friend gives her the gift, and Samantha says, oh, I don't like that. I don't want that.
Mm.
Right? And then I hear Michelle, my wife, intervene, oh, you know, because her friend got upset, of course, right?
Yeah.
Got her feelings hurt, and then Michelle was trying to explain to Samantha, sweetie, when someone gives you a gift, it's really sweet. It's a nice, kind gesture, so you say thank you,
mm-hmm.
even if you don't happen to like the gift, right? And I thought, you know, I'm thinking, I'm in the other room sitting there thinking, well, I don't know what I would say, but that sounds about right. And then Michelle and I were talking about it later, and what we both were commenting on was, wow, you know, while Michelle didn't intend it, there was a way in which part of what her feedback was is almost teaching Samantha to not tell the truth. Right? Now, you could say, well, you know, there's polite ways, and you could say thank you for the gift, and you don't have to mention, by the way, I don't like it, or I already have one, or I don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
But at some level, we get messages like that, subtle and some very overt, especially mm-hmm. when we're children, that basically train the authenticity out of us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get negative feedback for speaking the truth and saying what we want and how we really feel. So over time, we start to put ourselves into a smaller and smaller appropriate box
right.
so as to not get that negative feedback.
Well, I agree with you completely, and sometimes, you know, I've met some people in my life, and, you know, they would be just so stuck on being polite.
Yes.
And I would say, don't you know that being polite is lying?
Yes.
And there's such a thing as being tactful and kind,
mm-hmm.
and to be polite is saying you like something when you don't.
Right.
It's saying you like someone when you don't.
Yes.
It's instead of just removing yourself from a situation, you'll just stand there and act like you like the person instead of, you know, being authentic for yourself. And polite, to me, it's just another word for lying. And I get what people mean by it, and that it's all well-intended.
Yes.
And being polite is lying. There's no two ways about it, because you're just being nice to be nice without meaning it.
Exactly. Okay. And you and I are both from California. I know you're from Southern California. I live up here in the Bay Area. And one of the things, and I'm a native Californian, but my family's all from the East Coast. You know, and it's funny because there's this whole East Coast, West Coast difference, of course, we all know. And one of the things that people often from the East Coast will comment about us out here from the West Coast, and look, people who live around the world or middle of the country, you know, I think you can relate to this analogy anyway because we hear about it and see it. It's sort of like we're sort of fake nice out here in California. Oh, it's fine. It's great. It's wonderful. Whereas, you know, like people from New York City or whatever just sort of tell it like it is.
Right.
But I look at both of those as caricatures of what we're really talking about, because as you're talking about, the sort of polite, fake, nice thing is phony.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of, I'm going to get in your face and tell you what's wrong with you and tell you to get out of my way and stick it up the whatever, and you know, all that idea, while there's a certain amount of honesty and straightforwardness to it, I don't really think that most of us want to live that way or appreciate having people bark at us and yell at us and sort of tell, you know what I mean? Because
right.
The difference is, see, now, authenticity can mean and can be us sharing our opinions or our ideas or our thoughts or our feedback with people, but it's really more about us sharing our own personal, honest, vulnerable truth, how we live our lives, the things that we say. So, you know, getting upset with someone, there are times, of course, we are upset, and the very authentic thing to do is share that. But there are different ways to share our frustration or anger or being upset with another person. And often what happens for a lot of us, I know this happens for me, is that we get scared to say stuff. We don't want to make a big deal. We don't want to have a conflict. We don't want to bring up something. Oh, it might be uncomfortable or hurt their feelings. So we withhold it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens over time, the more we withhold it, when it finally does come out, it's often, you know, it finally comes out and we've hung on to it for a long time, or there's been 25 things we haven't said, and then we finally say it, and then it turns into a big deal when usually the thing that we got upset about wasn't that big deal at all.
Mm-hmm. It just festered and became infected.
Exactly. And one of the techniques that I teach in my book, and I do this a lot in workshops, both with couples and families, but sometimes I do a lot of work in the business world. I do this with corporations as well, is a simple on the surface to do it, but not easy technique called clearing withholds.
Mm.
So it's, you know, the whole idea is that, you know, and Michelle, my wife, and I learned this years ago from a coach that we worked with when we first started dating. He was kind of coaching us on our relationship and other things, and he gave us this technique, and we started to use it, and it was amazing, because what he would say, he said this to me in the coaching session with the two of us, he said, listen, Mike, for however many withholds, meaning things you aren't saying to Michelle or you're scared to share with her, he said, this is a bit of a generalization, but from a male-female dynamic perspective, if you've got one, she's probably got 10.
Mm-hmm.
So if you notice that you're not saying stuff or you're holding on to stuff, chances are there's a whole bunch of stuff that she's not saying, and she was kind of nodding and laughing as we were talking about this, but the way the technique works is that Michelle and I will do this, and a lot of people I coach will sit down and proactively create a safe space. And here's how the technique goes. I say to Michelle, there's something I've withheld from you. And her response is, okay, would you like to tell me?
Mm-hmm.
And then I say yes, and I say whatever it is. And some of it can be, you know, it could be feedback on parenting. It could be something that she did that I really liked that I hadn't mentioned. It could be something that really has been irritating me, something that I want, you know, for her to do. Wherever, you know, in the bedroom,
really like
there's some stuff
to
be really vulnerable. But the idea is that I just share it, and then her response is, thank you. That's it. And then vice versa, when she says it to me, just thank you. The idea is to get the things out in a safe way with no reaction, no response, no rebuttal, no nothing. Now, that doesn't mean we never talk about them. What we'll do when we get done with the withhold session back and forth, we may say, hey, can I talk about that one? Is that okay? And then we'll talk about it. But usually the charge, if you will, is off by the mere fact that it's put out on the table. And as we do this, and we often do this on date nights or when we're going to spend some time connecting, because we want to clear out whatever in the way. And I really encourage people, again, when I'm working with a team in a company, it's a great way to start to engage in conflict in a safe way. So we put the issues out on the table. And what you start to realize is the withhold, the stuff we're not saying, we think it's about the other person. It's not. It's about us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just hanging on to it. And once we get it out, we have a way of actually being able to work with it and work through it. But the more we hang on to it, the worse it gets.
Absolutely. And I just would like to give your website to our listeners again. It's www.beyourselfbook.com. And the name of the book, once again, is Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken. Transform Your Life with the Power of Authenticity. And you mentioned something in here, too, about being authentic with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
For me to be authentic with myself, if I could use myself as an example,
absolutely,
is to stop beating up on myself and either evict the negative voices in my head or charge them rent. And, you know, and that's a process that feels like, you know, passing through the eye of a needle.
Yes.
Because, you know, a lot of us have spent our entire lifetimes beating up on ourselves,
mm-hmm,
with this negative committees in our heads.
Yes.
And we don't even know that we don't know they're there.
Right.
And when we find out that they're actually there and you catch them in the act and you go, ow, that really hurt. Why did I do that to myself?
Yeah.
If that was somebody else doing that to me, I'd get a restraining order.
Exactly.
And you start noticing and you just get a bunch of ahas around, I'm really hurting myself. Why did I say that? Why did I think that?
Yeah.
You know, I made a funny attempt at humor, a little attempt at humor, which was pretty little, about I want to make a point, and if I comb my hair right, no one will see it. That's self-deprecating humor, and I don't generally do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it because I'm feeling in the spirit of being authentic and just letting people see my warts and all.
Yeah.
Well, and
I mean, you just said a bunch of really brilliant things, Kate, in that. I think, first and foremost, you know, the committee, as you call it, or I like to call it the gremlin, or the team of gremlins, kind of, you know, there's a lot of names. That voice that we all have some relationship with or awareness of that's,
mm-hmm,
constantly criticizing us. And, you know, one of the first things we can do, of course, is identify that, notice it. And then the challenge, I think, I know this is for me, and as we start to notice it, especially as we start to wake up more, the tendency, I think, is to then judge ourselves for having it. Like, I shouldn't have that voice.
Right.
I should love myself. You know, it's like you sort of can't win for losing, right?
Well, you're shitting on yourself.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But to just accept that that's part of what it is to be human, as far as I can tell. Can we transcend that? Yeah. Can we limit it? Yeah. Can we make choices and start to really train ourselves over time to lessen the amount of time we spend listening to those lies, if you will, in our mind? Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, maybe enlightened beings get to a point where that doesn't impact them anymore. But most of the regular people that you and I interact with and people listening to this show,
mm-hmm,
that's just part of what it is to be human. And the more we can notice it and have compassion for it and love ourselves anyway. But
mm-hmm,
you said it too, like, you know, if someone treated us that way. One of the things I remember from when I first started dating my wife, and Michelle is one of my greatest teachers in my life, and I just adore her on so many levels, but she said to me after, you know, we've been dating a few months, and I was having this conversation one day, all frustrated with myself and irritated and annoyed, and, you know, I was feeling safe enough to be vulnerable and share it with her,
mm-hmm,
and then she says to me, hey, listen, stop talking about my boyfriend like that.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, what? And I was stunned, and first I was like, but I was just sharing how I was, you know what I mean? And she said, listen now, if someone else were talking about you the way you were just talking about you, I would be mad at them.
Mm.
And just because you're you doesn't give you the right to talk about yourself like that, so knock it off.
Wow, talk about partnership. That's
yeah,
great.
And you know, it's like that kind of partnership. And again, empathy and compassion and space we can give each other as friends, whether it's our spouse or our family or our children or our people close to us. But at the same time, being able to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, you are important to me. You are a beautiful emanation of God, of spirit, of whatever you believe. And, you know,
mm-hmm,
and I don't, that's not okay. Because, again, it's like I think if someone were talking to my beautiful little girls that way. Now, I'm not a, you know, violent in kind of people's face sort of way, but I could imagine I would step in to protect my daughters. Absolutely. Like, okay, excuse me. That's not acceptable or appropriate, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what if we could have that same kind of vigilant love and support for ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And literally realize that that voice, that gremlin, that whatever we call it, it is literally like some sort of external negative force that comes and takes us over. But we have to be conscious of it enough so we can say, oh, time out. Where did I just go? Let me come back to what's true.
Right. Right. And you know, thank you for sharing that. And it's just beautiful what Michelle helped guide you through and brought into your awareness.
Yeah.
That, you know, in your book, it's clear that your daughters and your wife are very much a part of it and that they've been a wonderful mirror for you.
Oh, every day.
And
every
that
day.
They're supporting your being authentic rather than forcing you into status quo. I know there are a lot of families, Mike,
yes,
who, you know, it even happened in my own life where I was born spiritually wide awake to an atheist family,
yeah.
And that's not to put them down. It's just
no.
You can see the contrast,
yeah.
And that was our greatest conflict.
Sure.
Is the difference that we were with each other. And I was not a believer in status quo. I was a believer in expansion and evolving,
right.
And growth.
Yeah.
I mean, growth. It's like every single thing is like there's something perfect about it.
Yeah.
And I went around talking about what's perfect about everything, including what my mom was complaining about, and I got bonked on the head a few times for that.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, I was the black sheep of the family because I did not go along with status quo.
Right.
I upset the apple cart.
Yes.
It takes a lot of courage to be authentic. It really, really does.
Oh,
and I started as a kid. And, you know, I'm still working at it every day, and I don't really feel like it's work. It's like it's fun,
mm-hmm.
because I'm constantly stalking my thoughts,
yes.
to find out, aha, there's that other one that was holding me back yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm going to transmute that one into something that can serve me.
It's so great, though, Kate. I mean, I think so many people probably listening, a lot of us spiritual seekers, if you will, you know, for whatever reason, and we could probably look at it from a metaphysical perspective and in a psychological perspective, find ourselves in families of people who, for whatever reason, don't seem to get us or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Ram Dass used to say this great thing. I'm sure he probably still says it, but, you know, you think you're enlightened, go spend a week with your family.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
I think that there's something to that because our families often can trigger us at such a deep level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was doing a workshop, actually, at a religious science church just over the weekend. And what was interesting, one of the things that came up, we were talking about spirituality, we were talking about religion, and someone brought up a thing about some of, you know, one of their friends who's very sort of fundamental born-again Christian and the problem that creates. But as we got deeper in the discussion, in the workshop, with everyone, myself included, what I was challenging all of us to look at is the places within us where we stand in judgment of other people and think that our way is the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thing about that, it's a very human thing, it's a very normal thing, but even as we stand on our spiritual path and journey, whatever that is, and I'm someone who sort of prides myself on being very, very open and curious spiritually, but intending to be as inclusive as possible. Now, the reality is, though, there are moments when I meet people or talk to people or have conversations and someone says they're an atheist or someone says they're a, you know, fundamental Christian or they're a Orthodox Jew or whatever, and I have this reaction, like, you know, and a judgment. And then,
mm-hmm.
of course, I pretend like I don't because I'm open-minded and what, you know.
Yeah, or they say they're not into metaphysics.
Or whatever. And then immediately, you know, just notice, and the thing that I was talking about from an authenticity perspective.
Right.
And here's what happens to me when I'm around somebody, whether they're an atheist on the one hand or very, very fundamental in their religious
yes.
beliefs, whatever that is.
Dogmatic.
I'm worried about being judged by them.
Mm.
That I sit there and think, oh, no. What do I say and do, and what if they think, and they think I'm some kind of heathen or whatever, or what if they think I'm some kind of weird, trippy New Age? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In that moment, the part of me that wants to be liked and accepted
mm-hmm.
will then react, and then how it manifests often for me personally, and I think a lot of people can relate to this, is I then either overtly or more likely covertly get very self-righteous about it until I get around, quote, my people, and then I can talk about, boy, I met this guy, and he was this atheist, and blah, 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 or what, you know what I mean? Which I think is like we all got to stop for a minute, and again, with compassion and empathy, notice ourselves doing that. You know, Wayne Dyer said this great thing when I went to see him speak in San Francisco a couple of years ago, and I write about this actually in my book. He said, that which unifies us is of God. That which separates us is of the ego. So therefore, most spiritual practice, specifically religions of any kind, are of the ego, not of God. And even when he said it, I went, I turned to Michelle and I was like, he can't say that. That's blasphemous. He's going to get in trouble, you know. But then I started thinking about it more deeply and what he said, and I thought, wow, that's really true at some deep level. And whether we consider ourselves a sort of specific religion that we follow or we have our own version of spirituality that we've created, when it turns into a set of firm beliefs and ideas about how life is, how God is, and that our way becomes the right way and others aren't, it's all the same ego-based stuff that we got to start telling more of the truth about.
Dogma is not liberating at all.
Not at all.
No, it puts you in a box, in a prison.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that makes me uncomfortable around people who are very dogmatic is because I don't have freedom to just express myself as I want to without being attacked or
sure.
something. It's not about I want them to like me so
right.
much as it's about I'm not speaking to safe listeners.
Right. Well, and that's something to, again, to check in with. I love how you said that, because it's really about owning our experience. So for you, it may not be. This is something for me that I'm, you know, one of my things in life continues to be up to this point in my journey. For a myriad of reasons that I understand psychologically, but I continue to have compassion for myself, is that I'm a pleaser. Mm. And always have been. You know, my folks split up and lots of drama as a child, and I sort of figured out how to be the cute, funny, hey, look at me, everyone like me kind of thing, right? Which
right.
has served me well in my life, but it's definitely, as I've grown and evolved, has a downside to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more attached we are to people liking us, right, the more inauthentic we've got to be to sort of get everybody to like us, right? But the thing is, whatever it is, there are situations where you might trust and know your intuition says or your gut tells you it's not safe here. You know, and that's, look, there's a reality to that, at least in your experience, in my experience, and we got to trust and honor that.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about it is, though, that I would challenge you and me and all of us is that we often deem situations or people unsafe or I can't really be myself here or whatever, instead of, and it sounds like semantics, but I think it's a big paradigm shift to own that that's our choice and decision.
Mm-hmm.
You could be around the most dogmatic, you know, scary, mean, weird, critical person,
mm-hmm.
and it's possible, while it may not be pleasurable or enjoyable, to fully be yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you and I do this all the time. Look, you know, I catch myself every day going, oh, boy, what was that? That was full of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
because there are those places where, whoa, 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 it's starting to get a little scary or uncomfortable here. I'm going to go over here and stay in the safe zone,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's what makes, I think, authenticity both really exciting, but very challenging, and I've noticed as I've been talking more and more about this, whether it's on interviews like this or in workshops or when I'm speaking, I'm getting a lot of challenge from people and pushback in a way that I love, but also sometimes find like, oh boy, we're
well, that's because you're being authentic, Mike,
yeah.
and that's what I was saying about people's families.
Yep.
When you're being authentic, they feel like you're attacking them because you're not doing status quo.
Right.
And when you're being authentic, you are noticing your good points. You're actually amplifying your best parts,
yeah.
which makes them feel intimidated that you think you're better than them.
Right. Well, and then the question we got to look at is, you know, people's reactions to it can be varied. And then again, it's going deeper into our own truth is, are we being self-righteous and being better than? Because there are times, and that's usually a function of fear. Whenever I find myself, it's all ego-based stuff. The moment I get into a conversation where I find myself, whether I mean to or not, going to that righteous place of, I'm right, you know?
Yes.
And then I notice, oh, boy, what am I defending? What am I afraid of? Like, again, back to the piece about, you know, I think using this example of religion, because it's so charged for a lot of us, and I have a lot of opinions and reactions as well, but one of the things I've been practicing more recently in my life, when I'm interacting with people who are very religious, when I find myself getting into that, oh, boy, this feels a little uncomfortable, or I'm noticing I'm, you know, trying not to, but I'm editing what I'm saying or you know, whatever, is to remember that at some deep level, I believe that religion, the context, the construct of religion, it's really a beautiful thing in the sense that the idea is it's designed for people to gain access to spirit.
Yes.
And I think that all of us, whatever you choose to do, if you meditate, if you read books, if you go to seminars, if you go to spiritual gatherings. You know, I was just down a couple weeks ago in your neck of the woods and went to Agape, and I know you know.
Oh, we were married there. Go ahead.
Oh, what a wonderful, I mean, talk
yeah.
about, for me personally, and I, you know, Michael is such an amazing
yes.
man, and he's endorsed my books, and I just love and appreciate him and his support and his work. But
mm-hmm.
being at Agape, and anybody who's listening has never been there, I'm sure you've talked about it on your show.
Oh, yes.
It's one of the most unbelievable spiritual communities, and the feeling in that sanctuary and the energy there is so profound.
Well, it's pure inclusiveness.
It really is, I've been there 5 or 6 times and have seen Michael, and he's amazing, and the whole Agape experience is amazing. But something happened for me. I was there on the 3rd of May, just earlier this month, and something profound happened within me. A shift took place that I can't even fully describe. That's still unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
The thing, though, that I've been grappling with in my own experience, and this again is true for so many of us, whatever version of spirituality we engage with, is that what happened? Now, this doesn't take anything away from Michael, Reverend Michael, or the Agape community and that, right? But that shift took place inside of me. Now, it was instigated to some degree by whatever was going on energetically in that room and in Michael's sermon and the whole thing that happened to me that day. But that's the thing is, I don't have to go to Agape or go meditate on a mountain or go to a church or, you know, climb up something in Machu Picchu or whatever to have a spiritual experience. Neither do
mm-hmm.
you, but those things can enhance that.
Well, you had an epiphany, and one thing that's different about Agape is they have over 100 practitioners holding the space.
Yes.
For the services.
Yes.
And, you know, by the time you get to the third service, Reverend Michael is all revved up.
Oh, yes.
Pardon the pun. and we would normally go to the 11 o'clock service, and I can't count the times, the epiphanies that we've had. Pretty much every single time we've gone, we've had those epiphanies. And if I can digress just a bit, my current husband, we're newlyweds. We got married March 22nd this year by Reverend Michael at Agape at the 11 o'clock service.
Mm, wow.
And, yeah, and boy, talk about a sonic boom of love that went out over the world when that happened.
I bet.
Yeah, and it was at Agape, whatever Sunday it was, March 21st, I guess, last year, 2008, that we were in meditation, and I looked over at John, who was my boyfriend at the time, and we talked about getting married, and I said to him in a whisper, I said, I was just told that we'll be getting married on that stage March 22nd, 2009 by Reverend Michael. And my current husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, started to cry, and I started to cry. Mm. And sure enough, we got married by Reverend Michael on that stage March 22nd, 2009.
Wow, so just very recently.
Yes, and it was an epiphany over a year ago that came to fruition.
Congratulations.
So thank you. And one thing I wanted to share about that relationship is it would never have taken place had I not been authentic with him.
Yeah.
Because I thought he was the best soul brother I could ever want in my life, the best platonic male friend that I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
And I told him all my junk.
Mm-hmm.
I told him everything about me.
Yeah.
I told him the dark places in me, the bad things I've done, the you know, just all about myself, you know, things that I judged as bad. He didn't see as bad at all.
Sure.
And, you know, he liked me anyway, and he told me all his stuff, and I thought, wow, this is the best brother I could ever want for myself. And then he turns around and tells me he's charmed and enchanted by me, and I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means I want to carry your books for you, I want to provide for you, take care of your feelings, and I want to be your sacred partner. And I was like, okay, what's
wow.
a sacred partner? He goes, I want to be your boyfriend. So I said, how did you get in? I told you all my stuff. How is this possible?
Yeah.
And he said it was partly because I was so real with him.
Yeah.
And because I didn't know, there wasn't any courting on my part. I was just being
yeah.
me.
What's
and so, didn't care.
What a beautiful story. I so appreciate you sharing it. I'm sure people listening can relate to it on so many levels, because, you know, the beautiful part of that twofold is, number one, you know, you not being in that, let me impress him and show him how wonderful I am, you know what I mean, that thing we all do,
mm-hmm.
whether it's courting a relationship or in our work or lots of things that we do, we put our best face forward, and there's a part of the reality of life that's, you know, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the sharing of who you really are vulnerably, the metaphor that I use in the book, and it's an overused metaphor I know, is that of an iceberg, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just showing that top tip of the iceberg, the maybe 10% that pops up above the surface of the waterline, what if we made a commitment in life, particularly in our relationships, people we're close and intimate with, to lower the waterline, to really expose ourselves? And we often think that by doing that, it's going to have them run for the hills, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, you were thinking, oh, he's a friend. Oh, we got this great soul brother connection. Wonderful. And then all of a sudden, oh, no, I'm in love with you. I want to be with you. And it's like, wait a minute.
Where'd my brother go?
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure you guys had to deal with that piece of it. But at some
yeah.
level, there it was, the sort of all the stuff was out on the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's often why, you know, a lot of times in situations, although it does take work, and every relationship does, to really build it and manifest it and nurture it, but when people meet under certain circumstances that are maybe intense, or even in personal growth workshops, my wife and I actually met in a workshop, where we do let some of our defenses down, some of our mechanisms for kind of protecting ourselves in the world, and we get more real and vulnerable and say, here I am, this is really all of me, then there's a place where we can actually go, yes, and lean in and choose. Whereas the stuff that we're doing in our relationships, and there's so many stories of it, and look, I got to catch myself as open and authentic and transparent as Michelle and I are, there are moments where I notice I withhold stuff because, oh gosh, I don't want her to know that. I don't want to say that. I don't want, and it's not even that conscious that I'm thinking I'm going to lie to my wife and not tell her. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just the place in which we, even as we move through our relationships and they deepen on the one hand, it takes courage, I think, to continue to be transparent. You know, Mother Teresa had this great quote that I love. She said, honesty and transparency make you vulnerable. And then she said, be honest and transparent anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's really what makes beautiful relationships, any kind, but particularly with our significant other or our love relationship.
Yeah, and if you're not being authentic, you're not expressing your fingerprint, and that's the most delightful thing about you is what makes you different from everyone else.
Exactly. You know, and the thing is, they're literally, as much of a cliche as it might sound like, but there's only one of you, okay? There's never going to be anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one of me. There's
mm-hmm.
only one of your husband. There's only one of my wife. There's only one of everyone listening. And what happens is, I think one of the deepest reasons, and you and I were talking about it earlier, that we don't fully show up as ourselves in life, in relationships, in our work, in our families, wherever it may be, is that most of us believe at some level that who we are fundamentally isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
If I were just a little more of this, if I was a little funnier, or I lost a little weight, or I was a little smarter at that, or I was mm-hmm. a little more organized, or I was whatever,
mm-hmm.
fill in the blank. And we've all got our lists. Some of our lists are short, some of them are longer, of the stuff that we need to fix and change about ourselves, so then we'll be acceptable to a mate, or to abundance, or to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we literally withhold who we are. But I say to people all the time, and as I say it, believe me, I am talking to myself first and foremost. If you don't, if we don't, if I don't bring everything I got to the party, it never shows up if I don't bring it.
Right.
And we forget that all the time. And it's like, you know, I think one of the times that it does happen in life that we wake up as human beings, I think, is often in the midst of tragedy or when a death happens. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting, very emotionally charged topic, but I talk a lot, especially more recently, about death and some of my own experiences with people close to me dying.
Mm.
And I notice as I do, and when I'm speaking in front of a group or in a workshop, it's like, it's intense because it brings up emotion, a lot of emotion for people, particularly if they've lost someone newly or they're in the midst of grief, or it's a reminder of. And one of the things I think that we don't do very well in our culture, particularly in our Western American culture that's so focused on doing and accomplishing and accumulating and more this and more that and being beautiful and fit and all that,
mm-hmm.
we don't deal very well with death and dying
mm-hmm.
in terms of really addressing it authentically or talking about it or including it as part of life. Because, you know, my mentor was a beautiful, wonderful man named Richard Carlson, who wrote a fabulous book that I'm sure many people listening have read. You probably read it, Kate, called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
Oh, totally.
And yeah. Richard and I became very dear friends. He mentored me. He, you know, and was like an older brother. And just about 2.5 years ago, end of 2006, he'd just written the foreword for my first book, Focus on the Good Stuff. 3 weeks after that, he died very suddenly at the age of 45.
Wow.
Healthy man, you know, two beautiful teenage girls, beautiful family, sitting on an airplane flying to New York to promote the book that he had just recently written. He had what's called a pulmonary embolism, blood clot, and never woke up.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, just talk about it. And getting that phone call and then experiencing that and going through with his family, with all of our close friends who knew him, even to this day, even 2.5 years later, I still have moments where I look at Michelle and I go, I can't believe he's not here. So, but as shocking and sad as it was, and even there are moments when it still is, and I miss him all the time, although very, very connected, and I still communicate and connect with him all the time. His death more than, and I'd lost my father a few years earlier and had some other, and I write about this in the book, and the reason that I share about it is because Richard's death more than any other was so transformational for me. It's one of the reasons that I wrote this new book, Be Yourself, Everyone Else Is Already Taken, because the message I kept getting, both from Richard, but just within myself, was, wait a minute. And if this happens to a lot of us, especially when someone dies when we're not expecting them to, we all stop, and this is what happened for me when Richard died. I went, what is going on?
Mm.
Why am I selling out on myself? Why am I not really fully living out loud and speaking my truth? What am I waiting for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and look, do I forget that on a daily basis? Of course I do.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to remember all the time, and I think we can learn so much because there's that opening that happens often around a tragedy, sometimes around a peak experience, but it's that level of authenticity where we all let most of the BS of life get out of the way, and we tell people we love them, and we ask for what we want, and we say, this is my dream. This is how I really feel. This is what's important to me. I don't know why I've been dicking around about it, but I'm going to actually do it now. And that, there's such a freedom and a power and a liberation in that. And we think, I think, that it comes from the death, or it comes from the peak experience, or it comes from the birth of a child, which both times my girls were born, it was mind-blowing. But the experience that we have internally, the spiritual experience of that, does not come from that external experience. It comes from within us. And my attempt, at least at this moment in my own life and growth, was to put as many ideas in this book as possible for how we can start to consciously create that kind of authentic, spiritual, deep, real experience on a daily basis, not because someone dies or because something big happens.
Here and now.
Right here and now.
Yes, and with that, I'll just give our listeners your website again. It's www.beyourselfbook.com. The name of the book that you're listening about is Be Yourself, Everyone Else Is Already Taken. Transform Your Life with the Power of Authenticity. And just to jump back in on the topic that you were speaking of, Mike, my mom died a half hour after my birthday this year. She died actually on April 28th at 12:30 in the morning. My birthday was the 27th.
Wow.
And I didn't find out until a day and a half later because my sister was so devastated, they forgot to tell me.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm the middle child of seven, so there was a lot of chaos going on around that. And I was very authentic in my grieving, and I'm still, you know, grappling with it because when the waves come, I just let them come, and I tell John, my husband, you know, I'm feeling the grief right now. I'm feeling anxious, or I'm feeling irritated because I'm a little angry at myself because I'm not over this yet. And then I say, I'm judging myself, and I'm just going to let myself be. I'm just going to feel what I'm feeling, and he'll just support me through it, and like much like Michelle would for you. And it rocks your world when someone dies. My father died when I was 3 years old. I didn't really know him. And, you know, now I'm without both parents. So, you know, as my husband told me, he said, I think that maybe, you know, when you lose a parent, you've lost that filter. You've lost that person you can always turn to. Now it's on, and it's on you. And you're very much on your own when your parent dies.
Well, and now, you know, and so I appreciate you sharing, and my, you know, my blessings and condolences to you.
Thank
and,
you.
And to your family. And I, you know, to lose the second of your two parents, particularly, I also think there's an energetic piece of the same gendered parent. You know, I lost my father when I was 27, and my mother's still living, but I, you know, talking to people, and I actually really love talking to people about death and about the people that they've lost. Because, you know, you sharing just briefly about your mom, like, I can feel your love. I can feel your relationship to the degree just here over the phone on this interview in a relatively impersonal way, you could say, and you and I not knowing each other all that well until here we're having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's really beautiful about what you said that I just want to underscore and acknowledge you for, but also point out to everybody listening, is that when the waves come, you just let them come, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And that, from what I can tell, even though it may be inconvenient at times, it may be painful when it shows up. It may be like, oh, I'm supposed to have it together, and you know all the, and then the judgment you mentioned, which is all very normal.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing about emotions, and grief can bring up a whole myriad of emotions, most of the ones we consider to be bad, right, that we often suppress and don't express. But the reality is, look, when you get done crying, as I'm sure you have recently, about the loss of your mother. Now, when you're done, it's not like you're still, it's not like you're not sad anymore, or there's not still that there. My mom's still gone, and I still have that grief and that sadness.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an energy expressed, right? There's that feeling of, I know when I get done crying, even if what I'm crying about is something that I'm really, really sad or upset about,
there's a release.
It's a release. And it's also very authentic because it gets you down to that vulnerable core of who you are. And I've heard, I was talking to a man actually about this recently, and actually, ironically, it was a, another radio interview that I was on, and he shared with me that over the course of a very short amount of time, he lost his wife and one of his parents and his dog.
Whoa.
And what he said, and he was very, very close to his dog as well, so that three significant deaths in the course of like 4 months.
Wow.
And he said, you know, Mike, it shattered his ego into pieces.
Oh, wow.
He said, it just brought me to my knees. And he said, and as horrible as it was, and this was now, you know, like 12 years ago, he said it was one of the most liberating experiences of his life, he said, because it literally took everything away that I thought was important, and I hated it, but it had me go deeper within myself to figure out who am I and what's life really about. And so, you know, look, I don't wish it on people in the sense that, you know, that it happens, and but these things do happen. And as you said earlier in a brilliant way, it's like looking at life from the perspective of what's there to learn and what can this teach me.
What's perfect about it?
What's perfect about it, you know, and at the same time, you can act absolutely authentically say, it's perfect, and this really hurts, or this is really hard, or I don't like this, or I'm feeling sad. You know, again, we attach all this judgment to sadness, to grief, to anger, to, you know, despair, to whatever, fear. Mm-hmm. But what if it just is what it is? And if emotion is energy, which it is, and we all know, we can absolutely, the more authentically we express our emotions, the more real we are, the more in touch with life we are, you know. And the thing is that we've bought into this notion that there's good and bad emotions, or there's appropriate and inappropriate emotions, and therefore, most of us in life end up getting sick and dying at some level, on a physical level,
mm-hmm.
not from all these diseases and weird things and chemicals and all this stuff that we've, I believe, it's from an inability to actually confront and express our emotions.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. When you stifle your emotions, you aren't fully living. And it's for a person to grieve authentically, I believe it raises the frequency. And when a person raises their own frequency, it raises the frequency of the world.
Yes.
And when I told Gary Renard about my mother's passing, he's the one who wrote The Disappearance of the Universe.
Yes.
He's a friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Katie, I know you must be feeling terrible, and I want you to know that when a loved one passes out of their physical body, they are still just as constant as God."
Yeah.
Like God, they don't go away.
Right.
And
absolutely. And I mean, I imagine you can, you know, feel your mother.
Yes, and she's in a better position now to support and love me because she is part of all that is.
Yes.
I had I died when I was 19, and I was pronounced dead on the scene for 12 minutes.
Wow.
And the cardio pulmonary resuscitation, you know, my rib cage hurt for a month, and I decided on my own to come back into my body. And when I left my body, I became one with the universe, and there was nothing more painful in my life than trying to squeeze the universe back into this body.
Yes.
And the pain that I felt physically when I re-entered my body was incredible. And I later, after I was in the hospital a little while, they were trying to figure out, why did I die and why did I come back?
Mm-hmm.
And where did I go? I went to the fire station to let one of the paramedics know, who was a rookie, that his pencil was lodged underneath the seat in the back of truck number 33, because he was new at the job. He was trying to write down stats, trying to be on with the hospital on the radio, and he got all discombobulated, and he was so frustrated. And I went to the fire station. I said, "I just want you to know that your pencil's in the back of truck 33. If it's here, I'll show you where." And they took me out to the truck with the captain, opened the door. I reached in. I grabbed the pencil. I said, "Here you go." And he turned white as a sheet. And I told, you know, everybody there what all the people were wearing. It was 4 a.m, and all the people were wearing their flannel pajamas. And I was actually shopping when I was dead, because I now own a pair of Curious George flannel pajamas. And the point of that is, the captain of the fire department said, he goes, "I'm not surprised." I said, "That's wonderful that you get it." He goes, "Oh, you'd be amazed to know just how many people who have, you know, near-death experiences or death experiences come back and tell us exactly what took place."
Yeah.
So when I came back and I re-entered my physical body, I really got in Technicolor how when a person leaves their body, they do become one with everything.
Yeah.
And I know that my mom is that. I know that she's not in her ego now. She's not suffering. She's not in pain.
Yeah.
And when she was in her physical body, she had emphysema and heart disease and was in constant pain and had no strength, and wasn't in a position to feel love even for herself or anyone. So now, you know, she's in a better position to assist my siblings and I and whatever it is that we want to do in life, and I do feel that she's supporting me in that way.
Yeah.
And that does help me when those waves of grief hit, and I do allow them to happen. And I was reading from my journal the day after I found out my mom had passed to my husband. We do what you call preening every morning, and we read our notes to each other.
Right.
And it's generally 100% with tears involved, because we're so moved.
Right.
And as I was reading, you know, the door to having my mother around has now shut.
Yes.
Our bathroom door right next to us slammed shut.
Yes.
As hard as it could, and we just kind of laughed because we knew that was her.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I know, I so appreciate you sharing all of this so openly, because I think, you know, my feeling communicate about it as we're talking about this and having this conversation, obviously, publicly with other people listening, is so many of us have had or will have these type of experiences, whether someone goes through, you know, a near-death experience or an actual death experience and coming back or loses their mother or, in my case, my mentor or my father, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that happens, though, is when I say we, collectively and openly, we don't talk about it, I don't think. I mean, you and I talking about this, I think, makes a difference in the sense that let's normalize this conversation more.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not thought of as this weird thing and, you know, all these, because I think what happens, my belief about us as human beings, is that we're incredibly, incredibly intuitive, we're incredibly psychic, we're incredibly tapped in
mm-hmm.
to, you know, the other world, if you will, the other side of people, you know. But we don't trust it or we worry about the judgment of it. And there's so many documented cases of children in particular who are still so connected to that sort of divine
mm-hmm.
communication. And it literally gets, you know, we were talking earlier about children being authentic or animals being authentic and then it getting trained out of them.
I mm-hmm.
think the same is true in terms of psychic ability, in terms of understanding of awareness of, you know, the universe, if you will. I mean, I have fascinating conversations with my three-year-old all the time.
I'll bet.
And, you know, she is very, very spiritually and psychically connected and says things all the time that don't make any sense for a three-year-old, couldn't know that,
yep.
and hasn't experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
And we just try not to make a big thing about it or encourage it in some creepy way, but
mm-hmm.
in a real, like, you know, understanding of, and she is very curious about death, by the way, and since she's been born, Michelle's mother has passed away,
mm.
my uncle has passed away, Michelle's grandmother's passed away, a number of significant people in the family, and in each case, a day or two after the passing, like I remember when Michelle's mom died, Samantha, who at the time was barely two, was a Pat's here, which is Michelle's mom. We just keep having conversations, sitting in, you know, the dining room. Oh, where is she? She's right over there.
Did you get goosebumps?
Absolutely. And, you know, we would both, Michelle and I would look at each other, and we purposefully, because we talked about it, we didn't want to, like, have some big reaction one way or the other that would have Samantha be self-conscious about it.
Or repress.
Yeah, so we would just say, where is she? What's she saying? What does she look like?
Oh, how wonderful.
We were also very curious. Like, we're really into that. And, like, I'm like, I can't see her, but I want to know, you know. So it was more that kind of energy. And it's really wonderful, I think. And my hope, again, without it being a big, you know, not to go put her on display or do anything like that, but I think the more we all can have conversations, and whether we're talking about death and dying or we're talking about sort of psychic ability, and for some people listening, this may not even be something that resonates with you, but this, again, is an example that you and I just naturally and organically started to have this conversation about death and about your mother and about this whole phenomenon. That there are lots of things in life that we want to talk about, we want to engage in. I'm even appreciating, I don't normally have this conversation with people in general, especially not in an interview.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just appreciating the level of authenticity that's existing in our conversation right now. And there's something energetically magical about it because it's a feeling as much as it is. It's not so much even about the content of what we're saying. You know, when the truth, and I say that in quotes to some degree because we can argue about what's true and what's not, when the truth is spoken, it's visceral. I had a man come up to me after a workshop recently and said he went to see the Dalai Lama sometime in the late 70s, and he said, I didn't understand a word he said,
mm-hmm.
but I could tell the truth was being spoken. Like, I could feel it.
Well, the truth is the highest frequency there is.
Yes.
And when you're hearing the truth, you know it. You know it in your knower. And one thing I want to say, can you believe that we're up to our last 60 seconds of Spiritual Hollywood Hour?
Well, you said before we got on that this thing
yeah.
would go very quick.
It don't seem like 15 minutes. But I want to say one more thing to just get people thinking. And please pick up this book. You will meet yourself in this book. One thing that I wanted to bring up is Alzheimer's patients are some of the most authentic people there are as well.
Yes.
And when you speak to them, like what they're saying to you is fact and it's their reality, you can actually bring them around to being with you again instead of checked out.
Yeah.
And as long as you just talk with them like you did with Samantha, like where is Pat? Where's Grandma? What's she doing? And all of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's what's normal.
Yes.
And this kind of conversation is what's normal, and parapsychology is normal, and what's the term, supernatural? Well, it's called supernatural because it's natural in a super kind of way.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, we're all sorcerers and sorceresses as long as we're connected to Source.
I agree.
And you certainly are, Mike, and I'm honored to get a chance to interview you and to share your energy and to just, you know, have you be expressed in the audience that I have on Spiritual Hollywood. And I really encourage everyone to pick up this book. It's a very easy read. It's very heartfelt. You'll really get the essence of the spirit that wrote this, and you'll feel his entire family lifting him up as you read it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a beautiful, beautiful book, and I really thank you for your good work, Mike, and that you listen to your calling and you're acting on it. And if you took 10 seconds to say something burning in your heart, what would it be?
Well, first of all, thank you. And I think the last thing that I'll just say is that I think the most important thing for all of us, and we've been talking about it in different ways, is just for all of us to love ourselves as abundantly as we can.
And abundance will be yours. Yep. www.beyourselfbook.com. The name of the book is Be Yourself. Everyone else is already taken. Transform your life with the power of authenticity. I love saying that word.
Great.
And just remember, everybody, that the last six letters of attraction are action. So do what Mike has done and create the life that you love. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week, and good night, everyone.